Welcome to the Village Celebration, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Vicki Newton. We have a very special guest today. We are joined by Dr. Bernice King, and she is going to share with us today her thoughts about the latest book about her mother, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, written by Dr. Barbara Reynolds. Dr. King, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Vicki.
Your voice, of course, is instantly recognizable, just like your dad. So we don't even need a lot of introduction, but we do want to say you are the CEO of the Dr. Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolence in Atlanta, Georgia. This book is getting rave reviews, and it is distinctly your mom's story. So what is the most significant difference between Mrs. King and Coretta Scott King?
Well, I think people need to understand that she was not made as a result of being married to Martin Luther King Jr. A lot of people don't recognize that she had a very substantial activism role even before she met my father. She's a part of a progressive political party while she was a student in Antioch. She became a part of the NAACP. She was a peace activist. Very much stood up for herself while she was a student at Antioch College when she wanted to teach in the Yellow Springs schools, which were still segregated at the time. And she tried her best to make a case at all levels of the institution as high up as the president. She did not win, but she said basically that she was not going to accept this kind of system, no matter, you know, how long she had to deal with it. So those roots were deep inside of her before she met Martin Luther King. And, you know, in many respects, I think God had prepared and destined her life to intersect with his life later in Boston when she attended New England Conservatory of Music, and he was Boston University studying for his PhD in systematic theology. And so I think once people finish reading the book, they'll realize why, you know, within weeks after his assassination, she continued the work. She carried the legacy forward. She really designed and gave us blueprints for that legacy and how to remember and celebrate and commemorate and carry forward his work. And so she, you know, is essentially the architect of the King legacy. I mean, when my father was hated, he was one of the most hated, I mean, when he was assassinated, he was one of the most hated men in America. And now you have it in 2017 being one of the most loved men in the world, most revered, and still at the top of the list when you talk about the greatest leaders of all times. And so that, in my estimation, is a result of the tireless work of Coretta Scott King, the sacrificial work, and the fact that she embodied this. And so she was able to breathe life into its forward moving progress.
So let's go all the way back, because you make such an eloquent case for your mother's commitment to civil rights, even as a young woman. We're talking early 1940s in the Deep South when she took that stand at Antioch College. Where did her roots and her daring courage start?
Well, I would have to say her family, her parents, in particular her father. I mean, her father was very industrious. He only had an eighth grade education, and yet he was the only, at that time, colored persons in Marion, Alabama, who had eventually he owned, but he had his own truck. It was kind of like financing, what we look at today. And he hauled lumber with that truck and eventually set out to own his own lumber mill. It was burned down a couple of weeks after he started it. But he did not let it stop him. He, more importantly, he did not allow bitterness and hate to set in as a result of it. And he redirected those energies into continuing to move forward with his life, supporting his family, and fulfilling those things that were in his heart. And, you know, in the midst of all of that, as he was raising his family with my grandmother, who I'm named after, Bernice Scott, Bernice McMurray Scott, you know, he was threatened a lot for what he was doing. And many times pulled over on the side of the road by white citizens with a gun to his head. And he used to tell my mother and my aunt and uncle that if you look a white man in his eyes, he can't do anything to you. And so she said later on in her life, when they faced many threats in the movement, that she learned from the experiences with my grandfather, that she learned to live with fear for those that she loved. And so she, in other words, she learned to manage the fear so that it would not paralyze her. So by the time the movement came, she was very well prepared and equipped. But he had a very strong will and determination, and so did my grandmother. My grandmother was the first to really drive a truck. They converted, actually, a school bus. They converted a truck, my grandfather did, into a school bus, because at that time there was no transportation for what they called back then colored, eventually Negro children. And so they had to convert this bus to transport the kids, and she became the first driver of that. She worked side by side, oftentimes with my grandfather when he used to cut hair as one of his second jobs. And then eventually when he opened up his store gas station, which would be the equivalent of a convenience store gas station that we see all across the nation today, she worked with him in that store. And she, you know, she was a pretty determined woman herself. She often said that if she only had one dress to wear, her children were going to get an education. And she was insistent upon that, although she only had a third grade education. And so these seeds, you know, were already planted early on. Her grandparents, my great grandparents, were very active members in their community during that time. As well. And so my mother grew up with this kind of activism and service charge in her family, and very strong, determined, and focused, and I would say fearless family. And those seeds were planted in her early and then cultivated further when she went to the Lincoln Normal School that was set up by missionaries in Marion, Alabama. And that's where she really expanded her whole notion of why am I here? You know, early on she wondered often, you know, what is my purpose on this earth? You know, look up at the sky and ask those kind of questions. And that school kind of cultivated a global or a world view for the students that were there. And with, you know, living in the climate that they were living in, with segregation, and discrimination in the South, this is, I think, where the possibilities of I can make a difference in this world and change these conditions began to open up for my mother.
It sounds as if that resilience were just bred into your mom. It's almost as if it were part of her DNA.
It is.
And so by the time she met your dad, as you mentioned at the start of this interview, she was well prepared for a fight of the magnitude the two of them faced for decades.
And interestingly enough, I mean, the first real manifestation of a threat occurred with her in the home. My father didn't even face it. And that was when the home was bombed. My mother and father's home was bombed.
Yes.
And, 1956, January 30th. She was the one in that house. And she, you know, my father, when he came home, he was at a mass meeting. They would have mass meetings during the movement to kind of keep people focused and motivated and energized and to make sure that they understood the kind of posture they needed to continue to maintain during the bus boycott in Montgomery. And when he got the message and got to the house and checked on my mom and my sister, who was about two months, he was surprised by her level of calmness.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
yeah. again, it goes back to, you know, the experiences he had growing up with my grandfather. And I forgot to mention that, you know, even though she wasn't in the home, the actual home she grew up in as a child was burned down. And my parents and her brother, my uncle, were in the house when it burned down. And so they kind of lost everything they owned. She was away with my sister with the school choir at the time. And so, you know, all of these incidences just kind of, you know, gave her that staying power and that ability to manage in crises. And, you know, she had an incredible ability to manage in and through crises and to think clearly.
To think clearly.
Crises. Almost, you know, would do her best work in crises. She would tell us that all the time. She would tell us she does well in crises. That wit, that resiliency was there.
And for those of us on the outside looking in, there was a grace about your mom as well. So now we know that not only was she managing these crises very well, but she made it look effortless, and she did it in such a gracious way. How in the world does anyone do that? Do you marvel at your mom?
Well, you know, I grew up with it. So,
sure.
I grew up around it, with it. That's all I ever knew of her. And so it wasn't really a marvel for me. Mm-hmm. It's a marvel now when I'm dealing with my own.
Sure. And you wonder, how did she?
I don't have quite the package of ingredients that she had. And I look back and say, wow, God, how did she do all that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would just come apart. And, you know, I just think, again, it was the many experiences of her life and the examples that she had around her consistently growing up and the cultivation at both the Lincoln Normal School in Marion and then Antioch. I just think she understood that she had an important assignment and had to stay focused, and so she just kind of learned to have that kind of that grace and that dignity. Mm-hmm. I mean, grace under fire, but mm-hmm. it's again, I really think it's having a father who was the same way. I mean, you know, to have a gun pulled to your head constantly and not have a bit of hate in your heart is an amazing thing to me. And for her to witness that, she kind of drew, I guess, vicariously from his strength and his dignity in facing all of that. And, you know, they were very close, in fact. Mm-hmm. Growing up, and I recall them talking a lot, her and mm-hmm. my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, yes, I mean, I don't know how she did it, but she, you know, she was a praying woman, certainly. She prayed a lot, and she read the scriptures, and she had a strong faith.
And
another thing, physically to spiritually, I mean, as a child, she was just a strong woman. Mm-hmm. Even though she was smaller than a lot of people, she was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
She picked more cotton than anybody, including the males. You know, that during her childhood, she would end up, you know, getting in the middle of things and fighting and taking up for people.
She was just one of them.
That later became a very nonviolent woman. Mm-hmm. But, you know, early in her life, she was a little violent. You know, all of these things translated and transformed into a very strong, dignified, graceful, determined, focused, resilient woman, and thank God for her.
Amen. And so even after her death in 2006, early 2006, to this time, her commitment and her resilience still touch a nation. And I'm referencing the letter that Mrs. King wrote about Jeff Sessions that most recently was read on the floor of the Senate and landed Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, if you will, in a bit of hot water, but she did persist. What are your thoughts about the letter your mother wrote, about the now Attorney General, and the response to the letter?
Well, my mother, you know, was a strong advocate for a lot of causes, and if anything was very dear to her heart, you know, she would get involved, and she would speak what she felt was true. Mm-hmm. And at that particular time, one of the gentlemen, and I'm losing his name right now, she was had a very close relationship with growing up in Perry County, Alabama. And so, you know, she, you know, when she felt that someone was wronged, and there's an injustice done, it goes back to in childhood how she would, you know, get into the fight and kind of beat the other people up. But in this case,
not afraid to get her hands dirty.
Use mm-hmm. very graceful language, I think, to is what we say, speak truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the case in this particular situation. I was unaware that letter even existed.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it very ironic that the time in which it appeared was the same exact time as her book was being released. I don't think that's an irony. Mm-hmm. I think it just says to us that not only do we need to pay attention to Martin Luther King and his work, but we also need to pay attention to the woman who really helped us to understand and appreciate.
Mm-hmm. To grow into our appreciation.
Work that she's doing and mm-hmm. did, should I say. Mm-hmm. And so the response that we got across the nation obviously is in sync with where we are in these times as a woman. I think there is an emergence now of women in terms of their voice and their place in society that, you know, is long overdue. And we know that from the millions of women who marched in January.
Indeed.
Right after the inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I say it's the century of the woman. And so here we have her voice emerging and speaking to us out of the past into the present and really charging us and reminding us that we have to be, you know, vigilant. And yes, Senator Warren was persistent, and I applauded her
mm-hmm.
on Twitter for that, courageous. And that's what it's going to take today. I think it took courage for my mother to write that, and even more courage for her to write it the letter was written to Senator Strom Thurmond.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just fearless, I mean, and determined. And that's what it's going to take today. And so when people decided to, in spite of what happened in Congress, people decided to reread those letters in different venues and different
mm-hmm.
places, I thought it was very powerful because, mm-hmm. to me, words are very powerful when you put them out in an atmosphere. And, it, you know,
mm-hmm.
yeah, so, a few weeks later, what happened with Senator Sessions having to recuse himself. And we don't know what else is going to come up. But at least we have this record of her speaking back in the 80s for us to to continue to refer to and be reminded of, and so, you know, there probably will be some other things as we go forward as well,
You're listening to The Village Celebration, and our guest is Dr. Bernice King. Back in a moment. Welcome back to The Village Celebration. We are so honored and delighted to have as our guest today Dr. Bernice King. Dr. King, at 17, when many of us were just trying to drive a car, you were speaking at the United Nations for your mom on her behalf. What advice did she share with you then that you now apply as one of the heirs to this amazing legacy of your parents, both of your parents, who fought tirelessly and to their death for the rights of so many others?
Well, let me just give a little context. My mother was scheduled to speak at the United Nations on apartheid, and she ended up getting ill and was trying to get better. And in the meantime, reached out to both my brother Martin and my sister Yolanda to see if they could stand in for her. And neither one of them were available. And so I was sitting at the foot of her bed when she was on the phone talking to someone and letting them know that unfortunately she's still not much better and won't be able to make the speech. And she had asked Martin and Yolanda. And I just said, "I'll do it."
This is the quote-unquote baby in the family, okay?
And she's looking like, "What?" She said, and I was, my nickname at the time was Bunny. She said, "Bunny just said she would do it." So she proceeded to, finish that phone call and got off the phone and had a conversation with me about, recognizing what I was stepping into. She said, "Now you know that once you open this door, it's going to be very difficult to close it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you need to think about that with you being a student and all of that. And, but I'm going to let you make the decision." And, of course, she let me make the decision. And I did it, and she was right. It opened up doors. And perhaps, in some regards, too early for me.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe for other people, perhaps it was just part of destiny. She had a way of allowing us within reason to really explore and think about, decisions we were making. And she tried not to control those decisions, but she would, give us a little bit food for thought in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And the greatest challenge that she would always tell us whenever we went anywhere was, you don't have to be me, you don't have to be father, just be your best self.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, with a lot of, the internal expectations that you bring to bear when you have famous parents.
Sure.
And the external expectations that come your way, those words were extremely comforting and critical to my early life and continue to be to this day. And I have to constantly draw upon them to remind myself to just be Bernice and not worry about the big shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not easy, but it's certainly internally it's just comforting to know that she didn't have those, great expectations on my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could feel free to, explore, run away from, like in my case, my calling into ministry, and come to it, in the time that I felt at peace about it. And, just live life in a way that I can find me and my place. And so it's been extremely helpful from that day because, she allowed me to begin the process of knowing Bernice.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that's important for any child, really. And any person, it's important to know who you are, and to know your gifts and talents, and not have the pressure of whatever else anybody else thinks. And so today it's easier for me to carry forward their work because I wasn't forced to do it.
Mm-hmm. How very loving.
Yeah.
And wise.
She never said we had to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now it's like, I don't feel like have to, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
I have to because I want to.
And as
I
in
mean,
the
it's,
times
it's,
were demanded.
It's a part of me.
Yes, the times demanded, it would seem, as opposed to you're saying to your mother, forcing it up on you. The times need leadership, the times in which we live. And you mentioned this time for women in particular. The book, My Love, My Life, My Legacy, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, it offers such a powerful example for anyone willing to take a courageous stance. For women in particular, would you say? African Americans in particular?
I would say for anyone who feels powerless, period.
Mm.
Anyone who's seeking a way to make a difference. I mean, my mother was one woman, like my father, like Rosa Parks, like so many others. But she was a determined woman. She was a focused woman. She was a woman of strong faith. And, you know, she taught us the power, I think, of true collaboration,
mm-hmm.
and the importance of strategy. And also, you know, she exposed, you know, some of her failures and acknowledging those, you know, and the things that she learned and drew from them in the process of trying to get certain legislation passed. And I know, you know, that's where we are with a lot of the movement and the protest and the struggles and the issues today is, you know, how do we really bring about change and affect policy in today's society, particularly when you have a minority voice. And I think, you know, she taught us how to connect
mm-hmm.
Our story across party lines. I mean, she wasn't afraid. Some people are afraid to cross party lines because they don't want to be maligned.
Mm-hmm.
But she wasn't afraid of that because she understood, you know, that we live in this beloved community and that you need people in every arena, on all sides. We have to learn how to work with them. And that's what she learned how to do. And they respected her. I mean,
mm-hmm.
and even though she went through some, you know, moments of persecution, like when she attended the Republican convention, and there was a little backlash from that. But amazingly, when my mom passed, all of the sitting presidents were at her homegoing service, regardless mm-hmm. of party. They all loved and respected her. And the one that could not attend wrote a letter and said he would have if he could have, which was Gerald Ford.
Mm-hmm.
So that speaks volumes about her leadership and
indeed.
Her, you know, impact. I'm not sure what ordinary citizen or what the citizen period could bring all of the presidents
mm-hmm.
To their homegoing service. I think she's probably the only one in terms
mm-hmm.
of a private citizen. So, you know.
You delivered the eulogy that day.
Hmm?
You delivered the eulogy that day.
I did.
When you look back, did you say much of what you wanted to say to your mom, or is that an ongoing conversation for you in many ways?
I think, you know, I tried during my life to say as much as I could,
mm-hmm.
with her. And, you know, and when she passed, I thought about, initially I was going to preach something more personal, but the Holy
mm-hmm.
Spirit gripped me and had me to speak a little bit more prophetically to the nation
mm-hmm.
and what her death really meant. because of the kind of death she suffered in her reproduction system, her reproductive system, with ovarian complications from ovarian cancer. And so I had to move from being just her daughter to being really the preacher, maybe even taking on a prophetic mantle in that moment. But it was different. I didn't know how I would make it mm-hmm. initially. I knew I had to do it. I mean, you know, out of all of her offspring, I was the only one, or I am the only one that's in ministry. I recall her asking me to do her mother's homegoing and mm-hmm. then her father's homegoing. Mm-hmm. So even though she didn't specify in any writing or even maybe even in any conversation, I want Bernice, you kind of knew that if she had me doing her mom's and her father's, yes. that uh-huh. I would be doing hers. Who else would do it mm-hmm. when you have a child who's in ministry? And so I was honored, and yet I was very tired and very overwhelmed mm-hmm. With a lot of thoughts. But, you know, I learned from her. It's interesting, when her mother passed, I kind of was drawn closer to her. This was back in 1996, because my sister lives in Los Angeles. And so I was the one here. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple of speaking engagements out of town that I had to cancel so that I could be with her. And I told my sister to go ahead and, you know, keep her engagements. Mm-hmm. And I walked with her and worked side by side with her on her mother's homegoing service, and I was with her. She called me when my grandmother passed, and grandmother was in a nursing home. She talks a little bit about that in the book. And she called me over, and I recalled, you know, just going through the process with her of packing up while my grandmother was lying in bed there, waiting for the mortician to come get her. And when I was in Mexico when my mom passed, it was like suddenly I had this image of my mother being my grandmother and me now being my mother. Mm-hmm. And drawing just strength from that process of watching what she did, packing mm-hmm. up things, preparing things, planning for the service. And certainly my grandmother serves compared to my mom, and my mom was much larger. But I think it got me ready. Mm-hmm. And it was so important because nobody in my family had ever intimately been involved in a homegoing planning. Mm-hmm. And I was the only one. So it enabled me to kind of help us out as a family and help my sister out. And we had to plan two big services, one a memorial service, a music memorial because of her music background, and then the main homegoing service. And I handled the main homegoing. My sister handled the music memorial. But there were certain things that I was able to say to my sister. We have to think about this. We have to do this. We need to do this. We need to handle this, etc. And it's only because I had that experience with her. And so that intimate experience from my grandmother's and then my grandfather's, I mean, and ultimately being here in Atlanta when she got ill and being close to her during that time, and then being with her in Mexico when she passed, it was just, you know, it was almost like I was destined to stand mm-hmm. in that spot that day to deliver her eulogy. God gave me the strength that I needed to do it, because I'm telling you, everybody who's lost,
I can't even imagine
how mm-hmm. difficult it is and the pain that you go through.
And then to deliver the eulogy.
But I was tired because we were in Mexico, so we had to get back here, and we were behind. By the time we got back, it was a Wednesday. She passed on a Monday. And we got back at like 6 o'clock in the morning. And so I was just exhausted because I hadn't slept mm-hmm. much at all. Just trying to get her out of Mexico and back to Atlanta. And so, you know, I just stood in the power of the Holy Spirit and did what I had to do. But after then, it all set in.
Well, you know, that's an example.
And there are moments, you know, now I have to sit still, and I cry, and there are moments When I think about some of the things she tried to, you know, or did not try, but she taught me, I think about things that she did, and as I'm trying to make decisions, not trying to be her, because there's only one Coretta Scott King, there's only one Martin Luther King Jr., and of course she told me to be my best self, but trying to extract some of the lessons from her life as I watched it unfold in my life. Mm-hmm. And so I was, you know, I'm honored and blessed to be her daughter. I told her one day, in fact, she made an appointment for me to meet with this banker. And when I left the bank, I called her up and I said, "Mom, I just want to thank you for the privilege of being your daughter. I am honored."
That's beautiful. What an extraordinary.
I wouldn't have had that opportunity,
mm-hmm.
but her being so gracious and setting that time up for me.
Such an extraordinary legacy. Amazing, truly an American treasure, and I believe the book My Life, My Love, My Legacy will give Americans an opportunity to fully embrace who Coretta Scott King was, independent of her life as Dr. King's wife. It's a beautiful, beautiful story, and we thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your reflections and your example.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We are praying for you, and we wish you continued success in all of your endeavors. God bless you.
God bless you, Vicki.
Dr. Bernice King joining us for the Village Celebration Radio Show.